And welcome to the Taylor Report. CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conan. How you doing,
Phil? Good afternoon, Phil.
And let's say right at the top, Phil's going to have a new show starting tomorrow at CIUT at what time?
At 12 noon, Classical Underground.
Classical
music from our perspective, and we'll just see how it goes. It's basically the idea is that this is a radio audience that is not served. And so now CIUT is going to do its part to serve this audience.
Great. Boy, that is something to look forward to, and I really wish you well. And so that's Tuesday
from 12 to 2. It'll be a 2-hour show.
O'clock. Yeah. Great. And by the way, I see Jacob Leibovich. This is it's too bad we're not on TV, huh? Today we're going to talk to at the halfway point, we're going to talk to Rick Rozoff in Chicago, because on April the 20th, NATO is gathering, and we want to all know, you know, it's...
In Chicago.
Whereas, you know, they used to say on those Buffalo channels, you know, it's 10 o'clock, do you know where your kids are? We should say, you know, it's 5, do you know where NATO is? So we'll be talking to Rick Rozoff, who is has this great site called StopNATO.com, and... he's full of. He's been one of the people who's really followed the growth, exponential growth of this highly aggressive military alliance, and exposed it for the liar that it is, because it was originally founded to, you know, North Atlantic Treaty, and now it's talking about its global reach, and that there is no end to how far it can go and how many countries belong. So we're going to ask him about all those things, and. But we're going to begin today with Aimab Mugara of RwandaHumanRights.org. And I think he's with us now. Are you there, Aimab?
Hi, Phil. Yes, I'm here. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're very glad to be talking to you, because you come from that country which has an exceptional political circumstance. It's been struggling with now for some period of time. And there is an outstanding... woman, politician in Rwanda who returned from Holland and wanted to register a new political party and to become, we assumed, a presidential candidate. And instead, she has been arrested and charged and put on trial, I guess, beginning last year. And the trial has just turned into what appears to be a farce, but it's reaching a kind of tragic moment, because I don't see any coverage in Western media to speak of. I don't recall the Star Globe, anybody talking about it. But can you tell us what the status of her case is?
Sure, Phil. So basically, a few weeks ago, Victoire was mounting her defense of serious charges that the government of Rwanda has raised against her, which are clearly political charges that they throw against every opposition leader in Rwanda. And when her first defense witness went to present to the court with his testimony, the judges did not want to hear him, and then eventually when they let him speak for one day. That night, the witness goes back to his jail cell, and he found his cell had been ransacked. All his belongings from the cell were taken, including any notes he had scribbled down while preparing for his testimony. And then they also took him that night for interrogation, just with the prison officials and the police, without any lawyer present. So they interrogated him, which is clearly against the rules, at least if you look at what's written in the Rwandan constitution. And then the next day, when it was time for court, when Madame Ingabire and her lawyers raised this issue, the judges did not seem to be interested in hearing about that.
They didn't want to hear that a witness's cell had been searched and that he had been interrogated by somebody in his cell. They didn't want to hear about that.
they did not want to hear about that. They felt that this was such a minor thing that was wasting their time. They, in fact,
I suppose they didn't want to be interrogated either.
Yeah, it looks like it, because when you look at these people, these people who are acting as judges, I'm sure some of them or many of them may be good people that really went to law school intending to do something like for justice, but then they find themselves in a situation where it's either you're going to convict this innocent person or it's going to be you who will be sent to jail or killed or tortured. But basically, on day two, when that witness had come back to court, the judges kicked him out and sent him back to jail immediately. They did not want to hear anything about all the injustice
yes.
that had gone on.
Yes, but we're speaking to Aimab Mugara. He has a great website, RwandaHumanRights.org. And, you know, Aimab, I spoke to a lawyer who has represented clients in at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and I was asking him about this case, and he said that he was struck by something the judges did. This is the only witness called so far, by the way, by Victoire Ingabire. It's her first witness. And the prosecution said, well, he can't testify because he's been convicted of something. Did I get that right, by the way?
That is right. And in fact, that conviction that was brought up in court, this conviction had never, ever been heard of before. This was the first time that out of the blue.
The first that the witness knew about his conviction.
Right. The entire time the witness thought he was going to have his day in court, and then the prosecutor show up saying, oh, by the way, he was convicted in absentia.
And therefore he cannot be a witness. Now, the lawyer said to me, well, of course, among the perverse and twisted things that are going on there is he's her witness. It has nothing to do whether he's been convicted or not. She has her right to have someone as a witness who can help bring light on the evidence in her case, whether it's a convicted arsonist or a bomb. That's irrelevant from the point of view of the defense.
Right. And the funny part of this, too, is so they're saying that this one cannot speak because he's convicted. And then on the other hand, the only witnesses that the prosecution is presenting against Ingabire, they're co-accused. So they're accusing these people of being criminals, and therefore these are the only witnesses they're presenting to the court. And yet they're saying, oh, but that other one, he cannot say anything because he's a criminal.
Not all convicted criminals are equal. We know that, of course, with Conrad Black, I guess. We have some insights into that. Aimab, could you remind us, I mean, this woman is really quite exceptional. People do not appreciate. Victoire Ingabire is a mother of three children. She has degrees, I think two or three degrees. She was outside the country of Rwanda at the time of the war and massacres that took place. And she toured, and she came here to Canada and met political leaders. It was understood people meeting her were wishing her well, and because they thought that she was finally bringing legitimacy, integrity to the political process in Rwanda, right? I mean, she did speak here and met political leaders, right?
Yes, she did tour different countries, including Canada and the United States. And when she went back to Rwanda, she was indeed even inside Rwanda meeting regularly with ambassadors of different countries in Rwanda. Indeed, a lot of people thought that this was the moment for Rwanda to really show that we've moved beyond what happened, that we're really ready to take the next step and be a democratic country that abides by human rights. And it's been quite disappointing to see that the current government of President Kagame in Rwanda, they really lost an opportunity to move the country forward. And in fact, they moved it backward. If you look at all the various opposition leaders that have been jailed
yes.
in the past couple of years, including, let's not forget, the vice president of the Green Party, Mr. Andrei Biserega. This man, he was, in 1994, he was a survivor. Like his family was killed during the genocide in 1994. And so he was considered a genocide survivor. Mm-hmm. And the government of Rwanda today, they're always saying genocide survivors, we're here for helping genocide survivors and protecting them. And yet, this man, who was the vice president of the Green Party, he was assassinated. His head was chopped off simply because he tried to be part of the opposition, simply because he tried to participate in the electoral process against President Kagame.
Yes, that should not be lost track of. You're quite right. And also, which should actually, people should be reminded that member of General/President Kagame's own party, one of the people who held his group together, I believe his name was Bizimungu, attempted to form a political party and went to prison for a long, long time.
That is correct. That's just before the previous election, which was in 2003. At that time, again, same scenario, all the people who tried to run against Kagame at the time, they also ended up in jail. And Mr. Bizimungu, who was the first president of Rwanda after Kagame's army went into power, Bizimungu was the guy who they put as the president to go through the transition. And yet, when he tried to form his own party that was separate from Kagame's party, he ended up in jail. He was in jail for about 4 years before he was freed after it was said that he asked for presidential pardon.
They play very, very rough politics in your country. This is Imam Mugara, and he has a site, RwandaHumanRights.org. Imam, could you comment on that? You said there was an expectation. Certainly I had the impression that Holland was going to sort of be there for Victoire Ingabire. They were going to follow this, and Amnesty and all these others. But are they? What do you know about them and why they are all so quiet?
You know, when you hear about the different representatives of different countries talking, they basically claim that they are waiting for the judicial process to run its course, despite the fact that everything points to this being a kangaroo trial, they seem to be closing their eyes. So, after Victoire noticed that even her first witness is being so intimidated, in fact, a few days ago there were reports that this witness, now he's disappeared. He was taken from his cell. And nobody knows where he is.
Her witness has disappeared.
Victoire's witness, the same witness that was in court and they had ransacked his cell the night of his testimony.
Mm-hmm. By the way, we shouldn't lose track of the fact he did give very interesting testimony because he said that the officials were going through the prison and bribing people to make statements and that he was a qualified authority on guerrilla fighting in Congo and had been a member of his organization. He said he had no knowledge of her, never met her, didn't know anything about her.
That is
very important evidence.
Indeed, he did say in court that they tried to bribe him so that he can speak out against Ingabire, try and incriminate her, and that he refused, that he did not want to testify against her, knowing that she's never been involved with his organization that he used to fight for.
Yeah,
and so that was his testimony. But then, with regards to Amnesty International, they had released a few reports mm-hmm. where they indicated that they see Ingabire's trial as a political trial, that they see these laws that are being used against her as being
The objective evidence is there. It's just that they're not, their findings are not being broadcast.
Right. I'm not sure what it is, but yes, there seems to be a concerted effort to keep this hushed and quiet. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why. Because even with regards to Amnesty International, they had a briefing at the United Nations just this past week. And at that briefing, they were talking about the general situation of torture in Rwanda, which is basically coming to light with regards to Ingabire's trial when you look at this witness who's being so harassed.
Yes, you can pretty much see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they mentioned a couple of interesting things. So the first one was they studied all these cases where civilians were jailed in military jails in Rwanda, and many of these civilians did not see a judge for months upon months. And then you had civilians coming to court and saying in front of judges that I have been tortured when I was in military custody. And then the judges said it's up to those prisoners to prove that they were tortured. But then some situations where, for example, the prisoner would say, I've been in custody for 9 months, and I was tortured in the past couple of months, and then I've been healing. But and then the judges would say, oh, so where is your hospital record during that time in the first couple of months? But the prisoner could not take himself to hospital. He was in custody, and the military never took him to hospital.
It's kind of hard to do, yes.
Yeah. And then you have other situations where the defense lawyers, Amnesty International was asking them, so when you were representing, these people, did you ask them if they were tortured? And then some of the lawyers would say, oh, no, I didn't ask because I didn't think it was relevant.
Well, they have a point in a Rwandan courtroom. You're right, counsel, it is not.
Yeah, and the last one about this torture that was going on is some of these prisoners, they would volunteer to tell their lawyers, the defense lawyers, that I was tortured, so I would like the court to know that. And the defense lawyers would counsel them, no, don't bring that up. Don't bring that up. The judges will be angry with you if you bring it up. It's not going to help you.
Very often that's a function of lawyers in almost every system. They smell trouble, and they say, well, let's stay off that one because the judge will just get mad. And it's really kind of – I mean, that's why Amnesty and Human Rights Watch and others are supposed to be on their hind legs and saying something because it's very, very hard for us to be the one who has to stand up and tell a judge that, because definitely you're going to be in some problems. Mab, I want to ask you something lastly about there was a Victoire Ingabire – dismissed her counsel and said, this is a show trial, I don't wish to continue. Then there was an argument, can she be forced to come to court? And I believe the judge said, we don't need to bring her. But are we in a situation where they will issue a decision in her absence? Or do you know what, I understand it, the decision may come as early as this week. Do you have any idea or information on that?
Right. So with regards to the decision, so they've postponed the decision to June 25. And so now on June 25th, at that time, it's not clear if she will be forced to come to hear the decision. But in the meantime, between now and June 25th, the judges have excused her from court after she said, I'm not taking part in this. Mm-hmm. So it continues without her. And then the final judgment will be on June 25th.
So it's going to be June 25th.
Yes.
Yeah.
However, her lawyer in Edwards has indicated that her team is ready to appeal. It's clear that these judges that are on this bench right now, they're pretty much, I'm sorry to say this, but they're pretty much a bunch of cowards who cannot go against the will of the state.
Yes.
Since the state has, of the various government representatives have spoken out in the media and said, we want her jailed. So, and the lawyers believe that this is what these judges are going to give them. So they're ready with their appeal. And indeed, they mentioned something interesting where they said that this case is not going to end in Rwanda. So I'm still puzzled by what that means. I don't know if it means they're going to eventually appeal to the East African Human Rights Court or which other avenue they're going to go to. But I definitely look forward to that case being eventually tried by impartial parties who are not threatened by Kagame's military and Kagame's secret police.
Yeah, in the meantime, we should go after every politician here and leader who met her and encouraged her and would say, you got to stand up alongside her. Anyway, Aimab, we are very grateful. RwandaHumanRightsWatch.org. I'm sorry, I said watch. RwandaHumanRights.org. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Phil.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Aimab Mubgara. And we'll keep following that. There's a lot of things to follow. By the way, Mick Collins has been writing about these matters, as has Ann Garrison. You can find them, the magic now. I used to worry about getting all these things right, but just go look up Mick Collins. He has material on Luc Marchal, who is a Belgian colonel, and he has spoken out about the miscarriage of justice at the International Tribunal for Rwanda, and he also has his problems of his own that listeners should know about. Luc Marchal was the commander in charge of the city of Kigali at the time of the shooting down of the president's plane and the outburst of fighting between the two sides of the resumption of the war. And four Belgians were killed on the night of April 6, 7, 1994. He, as a Belgian officer, it is now 2012, he's going through yet another legal proceeding where the families are seeking damages against him. Canadians should know there are also those families have been interested to bring General Dallaire to Belgium to talk about these matters, but that has never been choreographed, we understand. Those are just other things to know about. Jacob Leavitt is here, so we're going to ask him why. What's going on? Move closer to the mic. And you had a great meeting. I attended. Phil was there.
I was there.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
The gang was all there.
Yeah, no secrets here. So.
No, it was a great meeting. The iTaxi worker offices are only around the corner, so I generally listen, but when I can come down, it's better.
Well, it's great to see you, and congratulations. You had former Councilman Jim Broney. You had Gord Perks. You had this brilliant professor from University of Wisconsin, Eric Wright.
Yeah.
Tell us who the others are. It was a lively meeting. It's great to see a room full of taxi drivers. It's just like a movie. I mean, and talk about
personality. Somebody was making a movie, actually, while we were there.
That's right. There's an actual group out of the theater company called Passe-Muraille. And they've got a grant or they're developing a play. So they've been following the taxi movement for over a year, videotaping every mass meeting that we have, videotaping every other meeting anybody else has.
You have very photogenic, quotable people.
Yeah. Yeah, they know what they're talking about.
They do. The members all gave interesting talks.
Yeah.
By the way, let me just suggest a title for their play. I think they should call it Waiting for Lefty.
You know, it's funny because they...
And I know an author, but he may be not with us. What's his name that wrote Waiting for Lefty?
Odette.
Clifford Odette.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's probably... Call his agent.
Well, I did introduce them to the play, actually, and they went out and sought it out, and they're doing something similar. I mean, their play is from the perspective...
Just don't shoot the union organizer.
Yeah, please. Their play is centered on... The way it was explained to me is that they're looking to talk about the immigrant experience from the perspective of immigrants who see the city more up close and personal than perhaps any other immigrant community. I mean, they interact not only with, you know, white Canada, but they also interact with immigrant Canada in the back of their cabs. And so they've got a pretty unique perspective on it all.
The best political discussions in the city are still in the car, in the cabs.
Absolutely.
You know, you can pick up a cab here and get some commentary on the Middle East that would be far more sophisticated than anything you read in the New York Times or Globe and Mail.
But they, you know, the session was great. I mean, Eric Olin Wright talked about the example of Union Cab in Madison and really articulated a vision for how taxi drivers can achieve a level of shared risk and shared profit, which would take the edge off of the current economic climate for all taxi drivers by pooling, not only pooling risk, but also enjoying economies of scale. And so there was a real sort of economic underpinning to what he was saying. And I think that was well received. Councillor Gord Perks, I thought, raised some good points that some of the ambassador drivers were uncomfortable with, and rightly so. He talked about the need for the reform to also address the issues of shift drivers. And shift drivers are known as people who, you know, show up at the beginning of a shift, pay some money to somebody who owns a plate, and then, you know, they're basically on the hook for the rest of it. So he raised some really good points. It created some good discussion and reaction. And, yeah, it was very loud.
I was impressed with he seemed to be arguing with people who have what they call the neoliberal model. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get rich. Stop this. Wakey, wakey. Yeah. What you want is, a future. You want wages. You want health benefits. And, you know, you need collective action of one type or another.
Dr. Eric Wright made, a great point in the question and answer period. We talked about, you know, we don't expect a bus driver, a municipal bus driver, to generate income at the fare box that's going to pay his salary. But we pay him a salary nonetheless. We pay his benefits
Good
and
point.
Stuff like that. But we don't do that for taxi drivers. They have to, if they can't get it at the fare box, on a hit and miss basis, right, then they're not going to get it. Whereas the bus driver shows up for work, whether he drives with his buses empty or full, he gets paid.
One of the points he could have made, too, is that we don't expect the bus driver to buy the bus, whereas the taxi driver actually has to purchase
the
car.
Don't even breathe that, because somebody at the TTC might get the idea.
Yeah, there's at least two idiots at City Hall. I think that was a great idea. You're listening to Jacob Leibovitz and, by the way, Phil Conlon, who is starting a new program tomorrow, Tuesday, at 12 to 2 of Underground Classic?
Classical Underground.
I get it.
Yeah.
See if I keep talking to you. I'm bound to learn how to say this.
Where could you fit a symphony underground?
A lot of places. Yeah. People did some experiments last year. A world-famous violinist set up in a subway station in Washington, D.C., wearing jeans and casual clothes.
Wow.
This guy had just given a concert the night before, and people just walked by him.
Yeah.
And, of course, he did this for 2 hours. It was hilarious.
Can you dance with that? Yeah. You stand on your head?
And of course, it was all videoed, and there was a kid, a three-year-old kid, who recognized that this was great music. And whose mother just kept tugging him and says, "Come on, we got to get the kindergarten kid." And the kid didn't want to go.
That's great. We're living the YouTube age. You can see that? I can go and find that? That sounds great.
I think you can, actually. It was a Washington Post.
Well, talk about it on your show tomorrow. Yeah. Tell us all how to do that. This, by the way, is the Taylor Report, and it's CIUT 89.5 FM. And I want to mention, Lord Black has agreed to take us back, which I think is really touching because, you know, he's in a bad mood. He came out of an American prison. And yet he looked fondly on the rest of us and said, "Oh, all right." Even though he used to say that we kind of resembled a doormat. But he gave me some real insight how we could solve our problem, because we have a wonderful citizen of this city. He ought to be the mayor ought to give him freedom of the city, Gary Freeman, who was a librarian, who raised a wonderful family here, a great wife, who also a librarian.
Didn't steal from anybody.
Was really just one of those people that you're so glad they're there, the librarians. This city has already shown several times over, we do appreciate them. And he had, of course, grown up in Chicago and had a Chicago experience as a black American in the 1960s, and which should also have gotten him a Freedom Medal just for that. But so he came here looking to be protected and to have a chance to raise his family, and he did it. And he was his son played in the CFL, and there's a whole bunch of stories. Now, he, of course, a Chicago policeman named Jean Valjean hunted him down, and they actually took him down physically and hauled him back to Chicago eventually. But all that got resolved. Everything is over. His Chicago business is over, satisfactory. The judges, everybody says satisfied. However, he's not allowed to visit his family. He can't get a permit to come to see his own family. And yet, Lord Black, well, we all know. Now, so I've got the answer. We have to all work to get a knighthood for Gary Freeman. See, if he was Lord Freeman, no problem. So that's the stupidity of our opposition. We didn't go for the knighthood. I figured that out. So that's what we're going to do. We get a campaign. One of you must know the Queen, or somebody knows the Queen. We write a letter, and she comes into Chicago, maybe for NATO, knights the guy, and then the government falls on his feet. And they say, what else can we do for you? That's what we're going to do. We promised Gary Freeman. We're going to get him a knighthood. I think we're going to have to take a break, and then we're going to be coming back and talking to Rick Rozoff, Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM.
The MayWorks Festival offers a medley of artists and performers across the GTA, May 5th to 13th, with live music, spoken word, theater, film, visual arts, and more. MayWorks highlights include the band Dub Trinity, writer Michelle Landsberg, renowned artist Louise Lilyfeld, musician Evelyn Perry, and many more at the MayWorks Festival. Info at mayworks.ca.
Your support during the CIUT 89.5 FM Spring Membership Drive was incredible. Thank you. We're just $2,000 away from reaching our goal. So if you still aren't a member, now's the time. Go to www.ciut.fm and make your donation by PayPal or credit card and be entered into the 6 grand prize draws. Help CIUT 89.5 FM stay strong for another 25 years. We can't do it without you. CIUT 89.5 FM, from the roots up, 25 years and counting.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And we're back, and it's the Taylor Report. I forgot to mention, you can write us at taylor@ciut.fm, and you can check out our website, taylor-report, where previous broadcasts are available. And like today's broadcast will be up in a couple of days. And I'm here with Jacob Leibovich of itaxiworkers.org. Is that right?
CA.
And Phil Conlon, whose program on Underground Classics. Classical Underground. Okay. I'm thinking that
I'm thinking maybe we should change the name, Phil. I think we're hearing the voice of the people on this one.
Yeah. Classical Underground. Well, we've got to wish you well. Break a pinky, they say, in that side of the street. And we are joined, I believe, now by Rick Rozoff of StopNATO.com, a terrific site, and provides all kinds of important information. But Stop NATO is part of a big operation that's going to unfold in Chicago May 20th, because NATO's coming to Chicago. Are you there, Rick Rozoff?
I am there. I wish NATO wasn't.
Well, you've done as much, by the way, as anybody to put a stop to them, and you got the perfect name for the site, Stop NATO. And first of all, why are they coming? I guess it's Rahm Emanuel, right? I mean, he's the president's friend, and
you've got it.
So he gets to have the thing.
Yeah.
Is he really happy about that, though?
In retrospect, perhaps his ambition is vainglory and so forth have probably told against him. Mm-hmm. No, but you're correct. And, as your listeners may know, if you live near Chicago, you know it for certainty, is that, the White House is the stomping ground for, the 21st century version of the Chicago machine. Mm-hmm. Obama, who cut his political teeth here in Chicago, of course, he's not a native of Illinois, mm-hmm. but he ran, became a state representative.
No, he's a native of Kenya, according to the right.
Yeah, one doesn't know. I mean, yeah. He's very cosmopolitan. Yeah. Oceania, Asia, Africa, North America. I mean, if he had to create a composite synthetic, image, he's it for the 21st century. But at any rate, he first ran for public office and then was catapulted directly into the Senate from the state legislature. in 2004, and he was being primed for the presidency even then. But when he got to the White House, the day after his November 4th, 2008 election victory, announced that the infamous Rahm Emanuel would be his chief of staff, and of course his chief political advisor was and remains David Axelrod, mm-hmm. who's another kingmaker from Chicago. And when Emanuel left, he was replaced by the outgoing mayor, that is Emanuel's predecessor's brother, William Daley, mm-hmm. as chief of staff until he in turn left. The reason it's being held in Chicago is what was seen as actually two feathers in the cap mm-hmm. of recently inaugurated mayor mm-hmm. Rahm Emanuel last year when the announcement that the G8 and NATO summit's going to be held in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I think they bit off more than they could chew.
Yeah, no, they spat out some, right? They spat out the G8.
Yeah, exactly. Fearing, I'm sure, that the G8 would attract, more economic protest, of course, and, perhaps a large contingent from the Occupy movement. And the White House no doubt thought that by rather abruptly shifting the venue to Camp David, they would take... they would diminish the enthusiasm for the protests in Chicago. It does not appear to have worked that way, fortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, but there is a new climate in America. We now have the phenomena of the Occupy, and we're seeing a lot of talk about NATO, pretty focused and pretty hostile. I mean, even it's coming up in the French elections. I want to ask you about that in a moment. But are you expecting... I should ask you, what are your expectations? And what will people be saying? And what are they going to do on May 20 in Chicago?
To the credit of the Coalition Against NATO G8 War and Poverty Agenda leaders, they have secured the endorsement and presumably the participation of, very large Service Employees International Union local, one that has, I believe, 70,000 to 80,000 members, the Chicago Federation of Teachers, a number of community as well as the trade union and other organizations, way beyond what one generally would expect, mm-hmm. in an anti-militarist or anti-war mm-hmm. Protest, and that's the major nature of it. And, of course, even though the G8 summit will be held in Virginia, the thinking here is still that the two are inextricably connected, that is, economic neoliberalism abroad and the military mailed mm-hmm. fist and the velvet glove, if you will, that is NATO, representing the same major Western powers control all the international financial and other institutions, mm-hmm. There's a commonality of purpose here. You're fighting the same thing. I think that, it may be time to dust off the old term imperialism.
Yes. Well, now that socialism is back in France, by the way, I don't know, to North Americans, that word is actually not supposed to be uttered. We have kind of a prohibition. So I guess... maybe it's time to dust off Albert Einstein's Why Socialism.
It's a great essay.
Yeah. He was a fairly bright guy, and he seems to be in favor. Now, what about this? There are a lot of people getting their hopes up. I don't suppose you are getting too much of that. But with the downfall of Sarkozy, which much of his problems had to do with NATO activity, and particularly on the economic front, what about France's role in NATO? Do you know, is Sarkozy taking a different stance on to see?
Yeah, historically, in fact, 3 years ago in 2009, the 60th anniversary of the founding of NATO. Because of that, in part, it was the only time that a NATO summit was held in two countries, mm-hmm. on both sides of the French-German border, in Strasbourg in France and in Kiel on the German side. And shortly before, Sarkozy delivered on his promise to reintegrate France into the military structure of NATO, something that Charles de Gaulle had taken it out of in 1966, even expelling what's called Supreme Headquarters Allied Command Europe from Paris to where it's now headquartered in Mons, Belgium. Mm-hmm. So, this was a real reversal that... After 43 years of, or more than that, of, 43 years mm-hmm. of being out of NATO's integrated military command structure, Sarkozy brought them back in. So his being booted out of office has, a doubly gratifying effect, I suppose, in that sense, in mm-hmm. addition to his being one of the two prime movers, arguably the major, in the war against Libya last year.
Yes, that is, we should take heart from that, that... there was they tried to sell all this as inevitable. It does appear there are plenty of people in Europe who are not enthused about this expansion, continual expansion of NATO and its aggressive conduct.
Sure, but I would be a little less sanguine or optimistic about what France under Monsieur Hollande is going to look like. There's no reason to believe that he'll return to the Gaullist policy, for example, of withdrawing France even from the military structure of NATO. I assume he's going to, business as usual. And you're acquainted with it up there in, north of the border, but down here we see it all the time. That, change in regime of one of the two major ruling parties in favor of the other produces only more bellicosity abroad. There was a tremendous sense of, I believe, a fatally naive optimism down here that when George W. Bush left the Oval Office, we'd enter the age of Aquarius. And, as we've seen, there's been an intensification of military attacks and a broadening of the war theater.
Turned out to be a movie prop, kind of like one of those Westerns where the looks like a bar, and you open the door, and there's a desert.
I wouldn't expect much in the case of France. Greece is, a little harder to figure at this point. They're both disturbing and encouraging signs. But here again is a country, burdened by economic difficulties, unemployment rate of, officially 25%, I believe, probably double that amongst their youth. Why there aren't political forces in Greece demanding the immediate withdrawal from NATO is beyond me, frankly. Unless, people are purblind. I believe that's a European affliction right now, is that there was opposition to NATO from the very beginning in countries like Greece when they were dragged in 1952, or Iceland at the year of the founding, 1949, mass protests and so forth. And people have simply become inured to this, evidently. So, they're accustomed to being in a U.S.-dominated global military bloc. Spending 2% of the gross domestic product, as they're obligated to under NATO obligation, it doesn't seem to concern anybody. But, I'm hoping that the reawakening of consciousness of an opposition to NATO here in the United States may send some, waves back over the Atlantic to Europe.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, you often address, and I know people always ask you to address this matter of what is NATO's mission? Because, as you pointed out in previous interviews with this program, they had claimed that they were there to stop the spread of communism and confront the Soviet aggression, etc. Well, okay, the Soviets went away. I believe, didn't Russia even ask to join NATO or something? But
yeah, in the early 1950s.
Yeah. So what is this? How do they they continually now add members? They're taking applications like their visa or something?
I would more use the verb dragooning other impoverished countries, particularly in Eastern Europe, into purchasing the Western arms, the so-called NATO interoperability of weaponry, and packing their young unemployed sons and daughters off to places like Afghanistan to kill and be killed. There's a fundamental fallacy that lies, the very basis of the claim that NATO was set up as a defensive alliance in 1949 in the first instance. Clearly it was not. You had the, mightiest military in the world even at that time, an American, firmly ensconced in Europe, the western and southern part of it at any rate, and did not intend to leave. The pretense of a Soviet threat was what was required to, maintain U.S. military presence, particularly at air bases, but also, at that time, a fairly substantial, a substantial ground force. The introduction of U.S. nuclear weapons, initially in Britain in 1949, almost immediately after the founding of NATO, and several months before the Soviet Union tested its first atomic bomb. So NATO is also the entree or the port of entry for U.S. nuclear weapons in Europe.
Yeah. Well, and you've also pointed out, and I urge people to go to this site, stopnato.com, and this is, we are speaking to Rick Rozoff, who is responsible for that site. There is a new attitude, posture developing in Asia. This is a long way from North Atlantic, but they're putting the situation there on a new footing once again with rather aggressive behavior. Is that the case?
I mean, the U.S. is. I mean, the so-called Asian pivot or Asia-Pacific pivot. We're a disproportionate amount of U.S. warships and military hardware altogether, you know, has been shifted towards the Asia-Pacific theater in the post-Cold War period. The collapse of the Soviet Union, the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact, both in 1991, you know, permitted the U.S. to shift military forces away from Europe. Mm-hmm. And they were, of course, you know, moved in large part to East Asia and the Pacific. But what we've seen recently, a couple trends, really. A statement as recently as last week by the top military commander of NATO, Supreme Allied Commander Europe, who is currently an American admiral. It's always a four-star American commander, who simultaneously is commander of U.S. European Command, incidentally. And it's now James Stavridis, Navy admiral. And he made a comment again. And, I mean, this, you hear these periodically over the last year since Obama announced the pivot to Asia, the U.S. is going to focus its firepower, really. The Pentagon is in the Middle East and the Asia-Pacific region, and there's a division of labor with NATO and the European Union, I should understand, that they will, police Europe for the United States, but also increasingly the Mediterranean Sea base. Mm-hmm. Which is not only southern Europe and northern Africa and the western end of the Middle East, but presumably also, you know, into the South Caucasus, you know, potential conflicts with Georgia and breakaway republics, even ultimately Russia.
We had a little war there.
Yes, yeah, 5-day war about 4 years.
In Georgia, in which immediately American senators, the predictable ones, particularly John McCain, said, well, this is it. We got to go and help.
In fact, they did. At the time the war began, depending on what part of the world you were on, either August 7th or 8th, the 7th in Georgia and the 8th here, Georgia at that time had the third largest troop contingent in Iraq, next to the United States and Britain. I mean, such a loyal ally is the megalomaniac Mikhail Saakashvili, educated at Columbia University, by the way.
That'll happen.
Yeah, Zbigniew Brzezinski's old haunt, as well as Obama's alma mater. So at any rate, they had somewhere in the neighborhood, as I recall, of 2,400 troops. And when the war broke out with Russia, when Georgia invaded South Ossetia and triggered a war with Russia, the United States flew those troops back on U.S. military transport planes, which, had the situation been reversed in a comparable manner, the U.S. would have seen as an act of war.
Well, and now that brings me to—I'm really glad you made that point, and this is Rick Rozoff of StopNATO.com. And incidentally, May 20, there's going to be a big gathering in Chicago to confront the NATO meeting. But I was reading, of all things, Arthur Schlesinger's diary, and he was talking about the— in a moment when they learned of missiles being placed in Cuba by the Soviet Union. And he said at the meeting he attended with the president present, the majority said, well, let's blow them up. I mean, blast them. Attack those sites. They thought of some other things subsequently, but that's the way the discussion went. Now, today we have something called a missile shield going on in a historic flashpoint of Poland. And I read somewhere that the Russians said, we could preempt that. What's that all about?
Yeah, that statement was from Nikolai Makarov, who's the head of the Russian military. I mean, this is the equivalent of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the U.S. Armed Forces, Martin Dempsey, currently, making a statement. So you have to take that seriously. He said that as...
when I hear the word preempt, I definitely sit up.
Yeah, right. Well, I think, the Russian perspective is that rather than preemptive, let's use the first word, the real expression word, first strike, is that the Russian concern is there's a four-phased, this is with the Obama administration discarding of the earlier George W. Bush missile interceptor missile plans for Europe, which would have placed four ground-based mid-course missiles in Poland and a radar site in the Czech Republic. The ground-based missiles do have a range of something like five or six times that of the standard missile threes that Obama intends to put in. But whereas it would have been 10 in Poland, and that would have been a bilateral arrangement between the United States and Warsaw, with Obama, it's in phases 2 and 3, they're going to be 24 Standard Missile 3 interceptors apiece in Romania and in Poland. And that's for openers. I mean, there's no reason to believe they're not going to install or station more. And as of the last NATO summit in November of 2010 in Lisbon, this is now not a bilateral agreement between the U.S. and Romania and Poland, respectively. This is now a collective decision by the entire North Atlantic Treaty Organization, all 28 members. So it also includes, and what's going to happen, in fact, in May 20th, 21st at the NATO summit here in Chicago, is NATO is going to announce that the interceptor missile system in Europe has reached, depending on your which expression you prefer, interim capacity or initial operational capability. And that's being achieved by two things. The basing of a X-band radar, missile radar facility in Turkey in January of this year, and the fact that last year the U.S. deployed its first what are called Aegis-class warships, but the first of those, USS Monterey, which is a guided missile cruiser, to the Mediterranean. And the purpose is to fire the ship-based version of the interceptor missiles, in addition to, you know, the 48 land-based equivalents I mentioned in Poland and Romania. But what's happened in the interim is Spain has announced that the naval station Rota is going to host four U.S. guided missile destroyers equipped with interceptors. And also earlier this year, the Netherlands announced they were going to upgrade several frigates for radar for the missile system. So you're going to see a continent-wide system. There are already missile shield elements in Norway and Britain and Greenland. And then on the other end of Russia, of course, they do have ground-based mid-course missiles in near Fort Greely in Alaska, not too far from Russian territory. So this, you know, first of all, Phil, this is a global missile system. I mean, this is the first attempt to really implement the Ronald Reagan administration's so-called Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars, at one of the major U.S. Missile Defense Agency headquarters. And not its official headquarters, but its practical one is in Huntsville, Alabama, which, of course, you know, is where Wernher von Braun and company developed the, you know, the A-bomb.
Oh, good, yes, Wernher von Braun.
But
he aimed for the stars and hit London.
I've never heard that expression. But there's, I forget, one of the former you know, directors or commanders of Missile Defense Agency's news person several years ago went to visit them. And they noticed, you know, right in a plaque above, or, you know, framed above this person's desk was a copy of Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative speech from the 1980s. So there's no question that the so-called missile defense and interceptor missile system, it has not yet bared its ugliest fangs, and the one that I'm sure is going to terrify Russia and China the most. You know, land-based and sea-based versions, and even, you know, ultimately laser-based, or, you know, plane-based air laser weapons are bad enough. But the next area is going to be space-based, you know, the interceptor missile components. And when that happens, then you've got Star Wars. And, you know, any country that feels it may be the on the receiving end of a first strike is going to get extremely nervous at that point. Though, as you indicated with the comment by the Russian military chief, they're already warning that as the phased adaptive approach, as it's called in Europe, progresses to its third and fourth stage, that the U.S. and NATO may well have the capacity to intercept and destroy Russian intercontinental ballistic missiles.
My goodness. We're speaking to Rick Rozoff, StopNATO.com. By the way, Rick has an article, Chicago Summit, NATO to announce activation of European Missile Shield and Global Research. You can go to that site. It's the May 3rd edition. Rick, I'm curious, the Russian, we see now with Putin is regarded as a fairly solid gentleman. Would you think that the Russian people watching and hearing all these things that you just outlined are thinking maybe it's time to make sure they have someone with backbone? And
well, that's a hard one to call. To be honest with you, now again, President Vladimir Putin, you know, barks, and he talks tough, and then he concedes. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's been the record, to be frank with you. You know, recently it's been announced earlier this year that, of all places, you know, the birthplace of Lenin, which is named after him, Ulyanovsk, Ulyanovsk being Lenin's birth name, mm-hmm. surname, is going to in some manner accommodate NATO by providing, you know, an airfield or something for the transportation.
How are they explaining to people their really kind of toughening language about Poland and then have that happen at the same time?
You know, I have no idea. I mean, I can't account for that. It appears to be, duplicitous. And you wonder if the anti-NATO rhetoric, justified as I believe that it is, isn't meant for domestic consumption. Well, you know, private deals are cut behind the back of the populace. But there have been demonstrations I've read as large as, you know, 8,000 people or so in Ulyanovsk, mm-hmm. you know, protesting against, you know, Russia's archenemy, let's be honest, you know, since 1949, whether in its Soviet avatar or its current, successor state status, mm-hmm. you know, the Russian Federation. NATO is building, has expanded, absorbed 12 new countries in Eastern Europe in the decade between 1999 and 2009, and they're all moving steadily towards Russia's borders in the Baltic Sea to the Caucasus. And
there is that fatalistic element or Greek tragedy element. When we talk about their mission, China and Russia do seem to be the ultimate states to be something done with.
Yeah, correct. And with Iran along the route, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And only because, you know, geopolitically and probably even more than politically. In other words, you know, where they are.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of, even the Tsar could have appreciated what's going on here.
Yeah, but you have to remember, Tsar signed a peace pact with Napoleon, and Stalin signed one with the Third Reich. And yes. you would think history has offered enough lessons.
You have me so worried that that's what I'm thinking. This tends to be turned into a repeat kind of phenomenon.
Yeah, no, you know, not that the West has another plan, you know, including, you know, fragmenting or creating political discord or fueling it at any rate in both Russia and China, you know, supporting Sub Rosa secessionist movements and such like. I mean, they have a track record of doing that rather successfully in other nations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, having recourse to the military expedient is probably the last resort if they could accomplish mm-hmm. what they choose to in some other manner. But I would guess there are polls, I think, substantiate this, but the general populace in Russia is highly suspicious of, probably hostile towards NATO. I mean, they understand what its purpose mm-hmm. has always been and is even more so now.
Yeah.
When they, you know, they can't even claim it in any manner a defensive one, and it's proven the fact that it's willing to wage war and able to in three different continents over the last 13 years.
A historical, unprecedented. It's phenomenal. Rick Rossoff, on May 20, demonstrations, and I guess it's going to go, 2 days or 2 or 3 days?
2 days. Sunday, May 20th, Monday, May 21st. The demo is going to be the demonstration, mm-hmm. protest march, which is going to go from the downtown area of Chicago, the Loop, actually gathering at the fairly new Petrillo Bandshell, then marching down to McCormick Place, where the convention is being held, is the big event.
Yeah. Monday, and it was a battle to get that, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And they've denied us the previous march route that had been agreed on when the G8 was going to be here, and then circumscribed that somewhat. And as I warned months before in an interview I did here in Chicago, based on past NATO summits in other countries, that people are going to get an object lesson on what NATO occupation looks like. Mm. For all the talk, and there's a public relations blitz that's really appalling down here, you know, propagandizing school children, not only secondary school, but down to, you know, the lower grades mm-hmm. of elementary school, you know, about NATO. It almost has a kind of we are the world flavor to it, without any mention of the fact that, like any other military organization, and this one being preeminent in the world right now, that it exists for one reason solely, and that's to wage war, to prepare to wage war. But it's being sold to people as, I don't know.
Lucky you, they say.
But what that meant was a report of about 3 weeks ago that Black Hawk helicopter gunships are flying over Chicago at night. They're going to be putting in embankments, walls, barbed wire, There are talks about already revelations about federal snipers being deployed to the city and so forth.
Yeah.
Roads are being closed. I mean, it's not only the economic and the transportation dislocation that's going to afflict people, but it's showing the military presence of NATO in Chicago, the heartland of the United States.
We're going to have to stop it there, but boy, what a story. We'll come and join you. Thanks very, very much, Rick Rozoff.
Yeah, please, if anyone is capable of joining us on the 20th, come on down.
We'll be there.
Thanks,
okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5. You can write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. And thanks to Jacob Leibovich, Phil Conlon, and Carol, and we'll see you next week.